WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Sun Ra was one of the great eccentric artists of the century. The jazz composer, pianist, and band leader claimed to not be of this earth, not born of woman. He implied that he was really from the planet Saturn. He took his name, Sun Ra, from the ancient Egyptian sun god. John Zwett has taken on the challenge of finding out the real facts of Sun Ra's life and the larger meaning of his self-created mythology. Zwett's new book is called Space is the Place. Zwett is professor of anthropology, African American studies, music, and American studies at Yale. He started the biography shortly after Sun Ra died in 1993 at the age of 79. Sun Ra's music was an amazing mix of avant-garde innovation, inspired reworkings of Tin Pan Alley tunes, and revivals of early big band arrangements. His concerts were like spectacles. Sun Ra often wore capes with planets stitched onto them and oversized headdresses. There was almost always a point in his concerts in which the band would march around the room chanting about outer space. That's Sun Ra, Space is the Place, and my guest is Sun Ra's biographer, John Zwed. John, tell us what it was like to go to a Sun Ra concert in the days you were going to his concerts.
It's worth remembering that Sun Ra's appearance on the scene as a full-blown entertainment figure precedes the rise of mass bohemianism and light shows and psychedelic rock and even modern stagecraft and soundcraft. So much of what he did in a homegrown fashion was really shocking to listeners, shocking to the point that people would flee the room. And on top of that, he would do things I think most people wouldn't dare do even today, like leave the audience in the dark for 5 or 6 minutes before it starts, getting the audience very restive and upset, and then slowly raising the lights up, or entering the room by crawling on their stomachs. You could only hear in the aisles the faint sounds of bodies moving or what have you. This is very unsettling material. And then what would a modal concert be? At times there were, at Princeton we know in 1967, 68, 10 painters were on the stage painting while the thing was on and carrying their paintings around. Or dancers carrying huge batiks with the lights flashing behind them, or muscle people, gilded muscle men, and midgets, and jugglers, and fire eaters. Anything you could imagine inside of this framework, which was often very much like a Wagnerian opera, sort of a Bayreuth throwdown of some sort.
If Sun Ra was just an eccentric, it probably wouldn't be very interesting to us, but the fact is that he was a really interesting composer and fascinating band leader, and produced some pretty extraordinary records over the years. Let me ask you to choose a favorite to play for us.
Well, a tough question, given his output exceeds almost any other composer's, particularly the recorded output, well over 130 LPs worth, and if you count the tapes and so on, maybe 1,000 items to draw on. I think Ancient Ethiopia, to me, is an important early work, 1958, from an album called Jazz and Silhouette, because although it has some roots in Ellington's, or for that matter, Fletcher Henderson's sort of programmatic pieces, pieces that were richly programmatic and colorful, Sun Ra was very insidious about his color. He would slip something in. In this particular case, there's only one chord. The entire piece is built on one piece of repetition, and nothing is changing but texture and rhythm. And there are precedents for this in Ravel's Bolero, but I find this more interesting than Bolero, frankly.
This is Sun Ra, recorded in 1958. Sun Ra, recorded in 1958. My guest, John Zwed, has written a new biography of Sun Ra called Space is the Place. Sun Ra totally recreated himself. He named himself after, the Egyptian sun god, and said that he wasn't human, that he was really born on Saturn. Why do you think Egyptology had such a strong influence on him?
Well, the easy answer would be that this is kind of standard Afrocentrism, and it's an attempt to root the history of black culture in the West stronghold, its bastion of cultural development, Egypt, and to say, at least, this is ours too, or even this was ours and not yours, and so forth. That's the easy answer. A more complex answer is to say that Egypt was a very advanced civilization, which is still hard to explain because its scientific advances are still escape our grasp. The grasp we have on Egypt is a little shaky, and historians are always a little slippery with it in revising themselves. Sun Ra certainly was aware of the arguments of von Däniken and Velikovsky and others that Egypt might have been created by aliens of an advanced sort and so on. That's not even a satisfactory answer to me, but that does provide part of the material. I think the this is an attempt to go to the root, to say the oldest god we know, the oldest alien figure, as Sun Ra used to prefer it, was the sun god, the god Ra, who was a complex figure in himself and had many names, as they say, names that were constantly changing. So he wanted to create a huge longevity here, to see himself as somehow beyond history, and this is as far as you can go on Earth. This is, as he once said, Ra is the oldest name for an extraterrestrial being that we have on Earth. And if you think about it, he's talking about gods, of course, which are all extraterrestrial.
Yeah, so in Sun Ra's mind, ancient Egypt and interplanetary travel and extraterrestrials all kind of come together in some way.
Yeah, and of course, Egyptian mythology encourages that, the solar boat, you know, all kinds of paths into the sun and so forth.
Sun Ra used to say that he wasn't born on Earth. He didn't have an Earth mother. Mm. He was from the planet Saturn. And then he told some journalists basically an alien abduction story about how aliens came, took him away to another planet, which was Saturn.
Actually, it wasn't Saturn. He doesn't say where it is. Saturn is a curious thing. I've never pinned down that he said he was from Saturn. He said he had an affinity for it. That in itself is not so strange. I mean, I think it's important to think of the fact that scratch any musician and you get a crypto-mystic of some sort. I mean, the music is founded in Pythagorean theory and so on, in a whole cult of mysticism. And it's not very hard to get a serious musician to begin to talk in a way that seems strange. I mean, Karlheinz Stockhausen, the German composer, says out front that he's from Sirius. Makes no bones about it, and then usually says, but I'd rather not discuss this because most interviewers start snickering. Sun Ra doesn't quite say that, but he does disavow an earthly connection. It's more important that he not be from Earth, that he not be born, than it is to be from outer space, partly because he said, like a child, he'd figured out that if you're born, it looks like you're going to die. So the thing was to not be born. And he put this to people many times. If you don't want to die, abandon your birth.
Now, as Sun Ra's biographer, your job was to, among other things, actually find out the facts of his birth and the facts of his childhood. And it's hard to do when the person who you're investigating truly believes or truly seems to believe that he wasn't born like other mortals are born. Mm. You track down some of his family members, including his sister, who remembered his birth. What did she think about the whole mythology that he had created and his kind of denial of real human roots?
I don't think she had been exposed to much of it. She'd been out of touch with him for 20 or so years, and maybe even longer. And I don't know what it, she certainly sort of brought things back to ground again by saying she saw him being born through the keyhole, which I thought was kind of amazing, by reminding us that when, as a kid, his nickname was Snookums, and in fact, his nieces and nephews still think of him as Uncle Snookums. This is very hard to kind of mystify this. In fact, he was furious when this got into the paper and called the reporter, Kathy Kemp, and Birmingham, trying to get a retraction or something out of it. I might have been upset, too, at the Snookums thing. This was just, you know, I think, you know, a sibling goes off and does what they do, and you don't worry too much about it. You worry more about, do they want to borrow money from you, or are they going to stay over the weekend? You got to get them a place to stay.
My guest is John Zwed, author of Space is the Place, a new biography of Sun Ra. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Zwed, author of a new biography of the eccentric jazz composer, pianist, and band leader Sun Ra. Sun Ra's band was, or at least part of his band, was almost like his cult group, his group of cult followers. Several of the band members lived for a while with Sun Ra in a house in Germantown, which is a neighborhood in Philadelphia. And my understanding is that Sun Ra had certain like basic rules of behavior that the band were supposed to follow. What was it like to live with Sun Ra, do you think? What were some of what was the code you were supposed to follow?
The odd thing is to me, I suppose, is that one was supposed to avoid excesses. At the same time, they embrace excesses. That is, you were supposed to avoid certain kinds of things, drinking, drugs, certainly. Drinking before gigs, certainly forbidden drugs, ruled out. Excessive involvement with women and so on. At the same time, they were supposed to be going as far as they could in expressive ways. So there's this interesting contradiction going. We always associate these things. Oh, we got to be drunk or we got to be high to get there. But this is not his idea. I think to put this in context, it's worth remembering that in the era of big bands, the comportment demanded by most successful band directors was often not that dissimilar. That is, Duke Ellington fired people for drugs, certainly, and for drinking. He had certain exceptions, but he, the Paul Gonzalez and so on. But it was part of that. And I think people put up with some things with Sun Ra. They wouldn't have put up with other people. All the musicians will tell you that when they first experienced this kind of thing, this kind of discipline, as he would put it, they said, what is this, you know? But the product was so important and so fresh that those who could do so did put up with it. And they would say, once you had experienced what he could draw out of you, you wanted more. It was itself a kind of an addiction to what one could achieve.
I saw Sun Ra perform several times, and I never knew if he saw any of the humor and fun in his work or if he took it all at some like larger kind of literal and serious and spiritual truth. In other words, did the stuff that strike me as kind of witty and fun and irreverent strike him as being literal and spiritual and all that. One of the things I found fascinating about your book is that Sun Ra is quoted in it as saying that he wants humor in his music, and he criticized the avant-garde for not having a sense of humor.
Yeah, he seems to be able to find in the most profound acts an element of the absurd, and was perfectly willing to laugh at himself as he did again and again, and break out laughing even as he was being profound. And he certainly did think that one of the problems of music in general, and pop music too, was that it was straight-faced, and it was kind of silly to watch performers get up, put on a persona, and stay right in that persona without any movement. He enjoyed watching things break down, or even creating a breakdown so that they would have to accommodate him. To name one incident that I mentioned is that Danny Thompson, the manager of the band and the baritone saxophonist, one night playing with several other horns out front, broke a piece of his baritone saxophone, and it actually sprang out into the audience. So it wasn't possible to play anymore. But he shoved his thumb into one of the holes left when the pad popped off so he could stop the airflow coming out and continue to play. But then when he got ready to stop, he couldn't get his thumb out of the hole. So he just kept playing, and then people realized he couldn't get his thumb out, and the audience went wild, and it was yelling and so forth. Then afterwards, he said to one of the other musicians, you see, he had real creativity. He was out there giving his all for the music, and he stuck his thumb in there like that Dutch boy in the dyke, and he just was laughing as he was telling the story, but explaining that this was the way music should go. You should be willing to throw away everything, start from scratch. In fact, he did disrupt musicians from playing wonderfully professional solos by doing things like shaking things in front of their face or playing things at other keys or setting up counter rhythms so they couldn't get away with the glib and the simplistically beautiful.
Sun Ra denied that he was born in a conventional way of a human mother and didn't publicly said that he didn't think he was going to die, you know. But he did die. He died before your book was written. He died before your book was started, actually. Was Sun Ra denying until the end that he was going to die? Do you know?
No, he was very sick, and he was struggling by going on these incredibly exhausting tours and trying, have to be carried on the stage and all the rest of it. Kind of thing that hardly any performer would do. Particularly one had to work that hard. So he resisted up till the end, and he insisted that the band go on. And even in the last days, just before he was returned to Birmingham, from which he never returned, he lectured them on the importance. The show must go on is the most important. This is not just a cliche. This is what it's all about. We're troubadours in the grand sense of the term, serving all of humanity. But I can't not say that he wasn't also depressed. I think when NPR... interviewed him at that point, just about a year that he died, he kept repeating, first comes the glory, then the shame, which was one of his worries, that there's a kind of ritual that all humans are bound up in. You get your glory, and then the shame, you're dead, or you're thrown out. It's also, he kept saying, like Joan of Arc or Mike Tyson, curious conjunction, and he was afraid he was falling into that too. And he was going to resist it and keep on going till the end.
What interests you in Sun Ra? What do you find in his music and in his personal mythology?
Well, that's easy. And I sensed this even before I knew too much about him, that the worst thing you can accuse him of is overreaching, going over the top of things. You could never once say he didn't try to go push hard. He pushed harder than anyone I know in the arts. He tried to draw out people. If it meant taking an amateur musician and saying, I'm going to turn you into a musician overnight, I'm going to shove you in with all these other people, and then tell the other people, listen to what the amateur can contribute, you're missing, or whether it meant saying, no matter how good you are, you'll be better when you're through here. Any kind of language and the efforts are almost forgotten in the arts. Most people are rather systematic now about what they're doing and this is where we're going and so forth. This is a person who said, we're never going to be there. Just keep going. And this is, in a way, that trip, that space trip they're on.
John Zwed's new biography of Sun Ra is called Space is the Place. Sun Ra's band has continued to perform in the years since his death in 1993.